Hello, this is a brief podcast talking about the seminar questions in relation to raising capital and securities law. It's late on a Sunday afternoon. This is going to be quick, due in no small part to the fact that the Sunderland game's just about to start. we're asked about the purpose of the Lamfalussy process at the EU level, as explained in previous podcasts and in the text that you've been given. The aim there was to try and beef up securities regulation. It was intended to move towards a genuine single market in securities. We'll see how far that's really got. It's meant to harmonise securities regulations. I would suggest harmonise only at the base level, because what we haven't actually done, of course, is to equalise securities regulation across the EU, due in no small part to the fact that each member state is entitled to gold plate its regulations. This is countenanced explicitly in all the directives. And due in no small part to the fact that the general law dealing with securities is different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, in spite of the requirement to introduce a provision like Section 90. It still doesn't mean that French contract law is the same as English contract law. So the Lamfalussy process is intended to introduce these deep pools of liquid capital by trying to create one single securities market with a passport for each securities authorisation across the whole of the Union, but there are obviously those limitations. So the Prospectus Directive is a part of that. Really what the general questions are getting at in relation to the various directives and the general EU policy is to encourage students to think about the way in which information is treated across the whole of securities law, ranging from the need to provide information in a particular form in prospectuses, needing to provide information to comply with the transparency obligations, needing to provide information specifically when you're having your securities listed, which goes above and beyond prospectuses, goes above and beyond transparency obligations, and also the way in which misuse of information is criminalised by the Insider Dealing Code and by the Market Manipulation Code. So I think just thinking about information and how it functions across the whole of those areas of law would be important. And then you could compare and contrast the way in which in England and Wales, cases like Caparo and Dickman have treated that slightly differently. So there's a big theme, I think, that runs through all of this that would be susceptible of treatment in an essay on itself. So just looking at these problem questions, I'm assuming you're going to have read on the first of the two seminars, question three, in relation to Wire PLC. The Wire is a great TV programme, and all of the names are characters from that, although they have nothing to do with issuing securities in any way. This is a first issue of shares to the public by Wire PLC. Notice it's a public company. The root principle, it seems to me, in relation to prospectuses, is that you have to comply with Section 85 of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000 in the UK. And this, of course, derives all the rules from the Prospectus Directive, but I'm just going to stick with the UK context for this podcast. Section 85 requires that you must have a prospectus, which is authorised and compliant with prospectus regulation, if you are either offering securities to the public in the UK, or you are seeking to have your securities admitted to trading on a regulated market. So that's where you begin. I think that's your first question. Does this require compliance with prospectus regulation? In defining what's meant by an offer of security to the public, we look at section 102B, subsection 1 of the Financial Services and Markets Act. And that tells us that there is an offer of transferable securities to the public if there is a communication to any person which presents sufficient information on both the transferable securities which are to be offered and also the terms on which they're offered, so as to enable an investor to decide to buy or subscribe for the securities in question. Now, question three just assumes that there is going to be an offer to the public, so you're not required to penetrate the mysteries of section 102B, but that's where you would begin. Section 85, do we need a prospectus? And in defining that need, we look at section 102B to ask whether or not there's been an offer to the public. So an offer to the public is an incredibly broad concept. It's a communication to any person which provides them with sufficient information in the ways that subsection sets out. So very broad indeed. So in terms of answering question three, you're just needing to go through the various prospectus requirements, which is basically just outlining the prospectus regulation under the Financial Services and Markets Act, that there needs to be a prospectus. So we're told also about the various people: Daniels, Greggs, Herc and Carver. There is an obligation, remember, in the background that we must ensure that our directors are properly trained and so forth, they understand their obligations. One of the great questions in relation to Wyre PLC will therefore be whether or not it's seeking to have its securities listed, something which is deliberately left unsaid. So you can track through the fact that prospectus regulations tell us about what's required in the prospectus if it's just going to be shares that are being issued. Then there's a further question, which is whether or not these securities will be listed. An examination question you would expect to tell you whether or not there's going to be listing, but the purpose of Section 3 is to make you think about all of that context. And listing is strictly, I think, on the second seminar and not on this first one. We're told about Herc and Carver in question 3 in part to give us a preface to question 4 and what it is that Herc and Carver might purport to be experts in. So question 4, Wyre is intending to issue its shares to the public. They're starting the prospectus preparation process, and we have to advise the board on the following sorts of information. Wyre PLC has developed a new genre of surveillance device known as the superbugs, which have a common design feature which makes them particularly robust. As a result, they can be concealed in small objects regularly left on the street, like tin cans or tennis balls. If you've ever seen The Wire, there is one particularly fun storyline where they do buy a tennis ball and stick a bug in it at their own expense, and then the drug dealer starts to bounce the ball on the ground and basically throw it around till it's driven over by a car. The superbug has no patent yet, although a patent application has been lodged, and Herc believes that the patent will not be awarded because it is very similar to a process used by another company, although Carver believes there are enough differences between the two designs to constitute a separately patentable process. So the question there is, what is it that you are required to put in the prospectus about this future patentable process? On the one hand, you'll want your prospectus to fluff this. If you're on behalf of Wyre PLC, you will want your prospectus to make it seem more attractive. So you'd want to follow Carver's line, that there are enough differences that you will get a patent, and therefore, if you've got a patent, your business is likely to make a lot of money in the future. However, the keynote covering this whole area is Section 87A of the Financial Services and Markets Act, and Section 87A tells us that we have to provide all information which is necessary for an investor. So, the fact there are doubts, and that Herc has these doubts, I would suggest, must make us think, well, don't we have to make that plain that the patent is still, up in the air? Both Herc and Carver have got degrees in electrical engineering. We're not told that there's any difference in their expertise, otherwise, possibly we might decide to believe one of them over the other. We've also got the fact that Greggs has commissioned a report from expert accountants, the Barksdale Group, which suggests that if the design receives a patent and has successful field tests, then we'll get 50% of the market for these kind of bugs, and profits are estimated then to be about £40 million. Luckily, that's something you will want to mention in the prospectus if you're selling these shares for Wyre PLC, because that makes them seem very attractive, makes the business seem attractive. However, you also, I would suggest, need to mention the downside. If the patent application or the field tests are unsuccessful, then there won't be such a large market share and profits will be less than 5 million. So that's important. And what we're going to want to rely on in drafting a prospectus for Wyre PLC is the fact that Stringer is mentioned, he's a senior partner of the Barksdale Group, and whether or not we can rely on him by name. And this will feed in later when we ask who are the persons responsible for the prospectus. If we have put Stringer's name in as being an expert who has suggested that profits might get as high as £40 million, that's a good thing in marketing terms. Here's this expert, he's told us this thing. In terms of his own personal liability, if things go wrong later on, however, we're going to have to think, has he approved his name going in or not? As is discussed in the prospectus rules, section 5.5.3, if you are an expert and you have approved the prospectus, you've agreed to your name going in. So there's going to be a question about whether or not we mention Stringer's name, whether he knows about that, whose liability we will create as a result. We've also got this issue about Bunk under Part C joining the company as its chief research officer. Because Bunk is very well known, it will give an enormous amount of goodwill to the business and investor confidence. Clearly, we want to be able to say in the prospectus that we want Bunk to be in there. However, Bunk hasn't signed a contract yet, and therefore we've got a question in the prospectus, as to how exactly do we word this. So all the time when we're thinking about these issues, we're going back to our lodestar in Section 87A of the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, and asking what is all the necessary information that an investor would require in this context? How much can we say? And if we do mention things, to what extent do we have to qualify our statements by the fact that, for example, Bunk hasn't signed a contract, so on and so forth? So that's important, working out whether a prospectus is required at all, and then looking at this central general duty of disclosure in relation to prospectuses. So Section 87A, to remind you, the competent authority, the FSA, may not approve a prospectus unless it's satisfied that the UK is the home state, that the prospectus contains the necessary information, and that all other requirements imposed by the Prospectus Directive have been complied with. 87A2 tells us that the necessary information is the information necessary to enable investors to make an informed assessment of the assets and liabilities, financial position, profits and losses, and prospects of the issuer of the transferable securities and any guarantor, and B, the rights attaching to the transferable securities. So very important there that we understand the financial position of Wyre PLC in 87A2A. Could we make this statute any uglier? That we understand the profits and losses, and we also understand the prospects of the issuer. So clearly all of these things about Bunk, about Stringer, about whether profits will be 40 million or merely 5, centrally whether the patent is going to be awarded or not, are going to be very important to financial position, profits and losses, and particularly the prospects of the issuer. So all those things need to be thought about. So what we've got at the end of question four then is McNulty, solicitor advising the company, drafting language for the prospectus, which says the board of directors of Wyre PLC are confident that the pending patented process for the Superbug will establish the company as one of the leading surveillance equipment companies in Europe. So problem there is we haven't said, we don't yet know whether the patent will be awarded or not, and opinion seems to be split as to whether or not it will. Our own engineers aren't convinced, Herc and Carver, as to whether we'll get this patent. So that's not mentioned, and I would suggest that is necessary information which should be in there. And if that isn't in there, when we come to question five, then we're opening up liability that there's a misstatement in the prospectus in relation to Hedley Byrne and Heller, which is something you're going to have to consider and discuss. We're also opening up the possibility under Section 90 of the Financial Services and Markets Act that this is a material omission, in effect, from the prospectus. And therefore, if these shares turn out to be less valuable than would otherwise appear, are the persons responsible, quote unquote, going to be liable for any investor losses? So to continue with McNulty's language, the agreement reached with Mr. Bunk, it's actually a typo there, I should say the level of agreement reached with Mr. Bunk to act in relation to Wyre's business demonstrates the standing of this company in the international surveillance equipment marketplace. Now, literally, that's probably true. The level of agreement between them, perfectly possibly McNulty has just made a typo here. The level of agreement between them does demonstrate, I suppose, that Mr. Bunk is interested in them, and therefore they might indeed be a good business and a senior company if someone of his seniority in the marketplace wants or is thinking about working for them. However, what it doesn't say is that we've yet to sign an agreement with Mr. Bunk. So if what McNulty meant to write was the level of agreement we've got to so far indicates how important we are, that's literally probably true. If it's meant to convey the impression that Bunk is about to sign a contract, then what McNulty said doesn't really help. We've named Mr. Stringer of the Barksdale Group as being able to predict profits of at least £40 million per annum. Well, literally, he has predicted profits, but he's predicted them on the condition that we get this patent. Whereas if we don't get the patent, he's predicting profits of being no more than 5 million. So again, we've got this question. Literally, this appears to be true. And I suggest what you have to do every time is to go back to section 87A and say, but is that providing all necessary information? Surely I would suggest investors also need to know that there is a downside to these estimates and not simply an upside. So there we go. Those are the three obvious issues there, I think, to kick around. What you're doing all the time, beginning with section 85, is there a need for a prospectus at all? That often requires you to look at section 102B about whether or not there has been an offer to the public. I think that's where this course is focusing our attention. And then you have to ask under section 87A, in preparing the prospectus, have we satisfied this general central duty of providing all necessary information? What you're also going to have to do in practice then is to go through the FSA prospectus rules themselves for the detail, the real detail as to how you go about preparing a prospectus in relation to shares. So a lot of that was done in the lecture where we looked at some of the general requirements in the information blocks for what needs to go in relation to shares. So some of that's on your handout just in bullet pointed terms. A lot of detail there you need to look at. So look on the FSA's website, see how that works. That'll do for this podcast. Slightly longer than I expected, but I think that really unpacks what it is we're looking for in answering question 3, particularly question 4.